listening to The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. For more information about the show, go to theunionedge.com.
Now here's a dinner I wish I could have attended. According to Associated Press, it was an elegant evening of fine dining in New York City's très chic Tribeca neighborhood. Celebrity chefs prepared a sumptuous spread of international cuisines for this truly unique ballet for the taste buds. The feast was called, quote, a transforming dining experience. Actually, it was not so much transforming as it was mind-bending. The dinner was hosted by McDonald's. The fast food mega chain of cheap eats was making yet another stab at enhancing its image, this time by trying to convince reporters that its food is actually healthy, fresh, high quality, even worthy of gourmet dining. Thus, the scribes were treated to such dressed-up dishes as Kung Pao chicken made with the chain's chicken McNuggets, enoki made with McDonald's French fries, and a pumpkin spice dessert fashioned from its biscuit mix. The closest I've come to such culinary pretension was years ago when I reluctantly agreed to judge a spam cooking contest, choking down bites of spam fricassee, coquille Saint spam, and spam spumoni. It was the food equivalent of dressing a pig in an evening gown. Some things are simply what they are, and it's best that we not pretend to fancy them up. Nonetheless, McDonald's richly paid honchos keep trying to elevate their corporate image from fast food purveyors of fat and sugar to, as the Tribeca Gourmet event tried to claim, an Epicurean establishment offering good food served fast. Their attempts, though, are all smoke and mirrors, rhetoric and stunts. The CEO proclaims nonsense like this: we've got to make sure the food is relevant. This is Jim Hightower saying, get real. Whether trying to gloss over its exploitation of low-wage workers or its health-challenging Big Macs, the McDonald's image won't change until the corporation does.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Hotel workers in Los Angeles won a major victory as the LA City Council voted this week to raise the minimum wage at large hotels to $15.37 an hour. That vote was 12-3. Already, some hotels are threatening to sue to block the wage hike. The council members who voted for the wage increase say it will lift thousands of working people out of poverty. Rachel Torres is an organizer with the Raise LA Coalition.
A lot of hotel owners already pay this wage and want to see uniformity in the market. But of course, there are those who want to, you know, stand on the wrong side of history and sort of believe that the poverty way to go. The city also is going to be looking at a citywide proposal. So unlike years before, they had said, oh, why are you targeting one industry? Well, in fact, the city is going to be looking at all industries, and we believe that the hotel industry is the first industry that can afford it. It's seen record profits, but I believe that, you know, setting a strong precedent in a strong industry will help mobilize and help move forward the citywide proposal that the council and the mayor are really eager to push forward as well.
Torres says labor activists who made this happen in Los Angeles are hopeful that it can inspire similar actions across the country.
We're hopeful that if we can do this here, that we set a strong precedent, not just for our city, but for the county and for other cities across the country to do that.
The $15.37 an hour hotel minimum wage in Los Angeles is effective next July for hotels with at least 300 rooms. A year later, it will apply to hotels with at least 150 rooms. The United States is moving to enforce labor rights provisions in its trade agreement with Guatemala. Radio Labor's C. Marie Ainsborough reports.
Unions fighting to help workers in Guatemala have won a major victory. The United States government has announced that it will begin the formal process within a trade agreement to investigate labor rights abuses in Guatemala. This is the first time the United States has used the disputes mechanism in a trade agreement to investigate the enforcement of labor rights. The decision comes after a long campaign by the largest union federation in the United States, the AFL-CIO. 6 years ago, the federation partnered with Guatemalan unions and filed a petition alleging widespread and serious labor rights violations. One of the charges against the Guatemalan government is that it has not investigated numerous murders of union leaders. The legal proceedings initiated under the provisions of the trade agreement with Guatemala initiates an arbitration process which could force the country to live up to its promises to respect labor rights.
Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays, noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio, reminds you to register to vote, educate yourself on the issues, be part of the process.
Welcome back to the Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. I'm Brittany Sheets here with Angela Bachman.
Hello.
And it's a very fine Friday. We've been having a lot of fun here on the show today, talking about all kinds of things. And to help us join in on this fun, we have our friend Buck Gino of Work in Progress Radio with us.
Ladies, it's always a pleasure to be with you. Always a pleasure.
It's always fun, Buck.
Glad to have you.
Well, today we're coming to you from beautiful downtown, actually, Minneapolis-St. Paul. Actually, Anoka, which is basically a suburb of Minneapolis. So it's a beautiful day here in the 80s. And I came into town yesterday, and I was listening to you ladies talk about wages and things, and that comes from an automatic thing for me as a labor representative. I started talking to the workers and the help and the management, and I found out something interesting. You know, you look at Minnesota, and it's kind of the best kept secret as far as workers go. I couldn't find a worker that was really disappointed with their job and what they were making, which was amazing.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, and you know, the only thing that I saw was that you do pay a little more tax, you know, as far as state tax and things like that. But I didn't find a worker, and I even talked to a manager today. We made a good relationship. I'm going to have him on next Friday, as a matter of fact. He's kind of the business owner, if you will. And he sat back and talked about how the climate of Minnesota, and he even talked about how he wanted his employees to be part of organized labor.
Really?
So it's amazing. Yeah, it's amazing. It's just the difference in a few hundred miles.
Yeah. Wow, yeah.
You don't have the animosity here. I didn't do a lot of research, but you don't have much discussion from even the teachers or the other public employees where they're unsatisfied and are looking for cause problems. That just doesn't happen here. And that what I found is that what we should have done in Michigan is when we started to pattern our state after someone, we kind of patterned it after Indiana, which was right to work. We should have looked to Minnesota.
True. Just look the other direction.
Sure. And like I said, it was really amazing to find people that were generally happy and wanted to do better by everybody in their community. And the only complaint I found was a few of the people decided that they thought the tax was a little too high, you know, from a combination of city tax to state tax.
Well, you'll get that everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
But like I say, yeah, but the part of it is that they have a little more progressive leadership here.
Well, that's refreshing to see.
Sure, all's not lost.
Yeah, all is not lost. There's hope in the world.
It's not. And I wish that more legislatures would take examples from places like that. They would look around and say, okay, this is working, this is not working, this is working for someone else. Maybe we should try it instead of just blindly stabbing at things like, maybe this will help. Oh, no, I guess it didn't. Oops.
You know, right. And we talked about this a little bit. We have in the past. It would be great. You know, if you could go to, say, a Walmart, I know I'm getting on the soapbox here, but I this could be a campaign. I don't know why one of these candidates, especially in Michigan, doesn't take this issue and put it right on the cornerstone of the campaign, is the fact that, look, if we have, what I'll do when I get to office is I'll propose legislation somehow. It may not pass. But if you have a Walmart, if you have a big box store, you know, Charles and I talk about this all the time, and if you employ people 40 hours a week and they still have to collect assistance or aid to dependent children or any of that other stuff, then you should pay an excise tax. You should pay a tax.
Oh, yeah, but you know all that'll do, Buck, is it'll make them say, oh, that's okay, we're just going to cut hours. Nobody works more than 25 hours a week now.
But that's that scare tactic, Angela. You know, you look, you know, it's just like out in Nevada. They did the same thing. Was it they wanted to build some kind of plant. I don't have the research in front of me. But then Tesla says, okay, we want a tax break, and we want to start at $500 million. And then the state says, whoa, wait a minute. Okay, we won't do it. It's just a tactic that they say. It's just like we're going to fold up the doors and move. They can't do that anymore. And like I said, I just think that, you know, everybody making a minimum wage, everybody happy, it's just such a different environment up here than it is in the state of Michigan.
That's true. And they say about a lot of just different companies that actually have happy employees and happy workers, and the companies that treat their employees well, the employees don't want to leave. Like, they actually like where they work. They have a good relationship or a better relationship with their management and bosses. And, you know, like, it makes you a happier place to work. And that can even play into literally like a person's health. If you work in a happy environment where you're not stressed out, you're not miserable, you enjoy going to work and you like your job, overall, you just feel better as a person. And that actually has like health effects that will stem from that.
Oh, sure. And to have a healthy, happy workforce reduces your cost even farther.
Yeah, exactly. They're much more productive.
Sure. I tell you how I gauge it. And this comes from all these years, you know, when I was an organizer, I was fresh out of the field. I still had all my hard hats and my clothes, and people were used to seeing me on the job. So I would sneak on the job as I was a paid full-time organizer, and I would go on the construction jobs, and I would hang around. And I looked for those workers. You know, you can tell when you watch workers, if you get, you know, just watch them. If somebody's walking down the hallway or doing them, they're whistling and they're having a good time and they're working and they're, you know, laughing and, you know, and solving problems with their partners or whatever, that's the kind of worker you want.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want a worker that's, you know, negative attitude or that and can't get it, you know, doesn't want to come into work. And the reason they don't is because they don't make enough money. They have no incentive to be happy.
That's true.
And like I said, it was amazing. And that's what kind of a little sideline hobby of mine is when I walk in, even to the hotel, I'm a shout out to the, you know, the Best Western Plus, a motel in Anoka. I'll talk a little bit about him. He's going to do an interview for us as management next Friday. But like I said, when you walk into a place and just watch the workers.
That's true.
Just watch them. You can tell if they're happy, if they're not. If I was an organizer and I walked down and talked to a non-union shop, two guys, and they were whistling and happy and having a good time, I didn't want to talk to them no more.
Yeah.
Because that's the goal of organized labor, to make sure that everybody's like that.
I mean, if you walk into like a McDonald's or something like that, I know, I just personally, mine that I have, it's just, yeah, not too many smiling faces. People are just kind of there, like almost like automated. They do their job, they move on. There's no, I guess, deviance to that. There's no, like, they're not necessarily always happy. Not saying all people are miserable that work in these kind of places, but I'm just saying overall as a whole, just because their work environment and what they go through, it's kind of rough. And we're going to definitely pick that up here at the break. We're going to take a short break here, but we'll be right back. I'm Brittany Sheets here with Angela Bachman, and you've been listening to the Union Edge Labor's Talk Radio.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Salvatore Calalori. On September 23rd, the United States launched airstrikes against Islamic State and Khorasan terror group targets in Syria. Right-wing media figures rushed to politicize the timing of the airstrikes. Here's outnumbered co-host Sandra Smith.
While we're questioning the effectiveness of these airstrikes in Syria and Iraq, I guess we should also be questioning the other side of this and question their effectiveness politically and the timing of these airstrikes shortly before the midterm elections.
Rush Limbaugh suggested.
So George Bush supposedly went to Iraq for oil, right? So I guess we can say that Barack Obama went to war with ISIS for the Senate.
And here's Sean Hannity.
So the president is basically checking the box, launching airstrikes so it will help Democrats.
No.
But while conservative media figures invented a political motive, officials announced that U.S. airstrikes hit members of an al-Qaeda offshoot called the Khorasan Group, who posed a, quote, imminent threat to the U.S. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Members of the American Postal Workers Union handle more than 165 billion letters and packages a year. That's about 34 million pounds of mail every day. Ever wonder what this costs you as a taxpayer? Millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions? Not a single cent. The United States Postal Service doesn't run on your tax dollars. It's funded solely by stamps and postage. brought to you by the men and women of the American Postal Workers Union.
When Dad needed help getting around, I became his driver. Soon enough, it was up to me to be his housekeeper and financial manager, too. When he moved in, I became his cook and even his nurse. But no matter what roles I play, I know I'm still his daughter.
We understand the roles you play. So to help, we created aarp.org/caregiving, where you can connect with experts and other caregivers. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
The International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 66, works with builders and contractors to build a better community. Local 66's tradesmen and women have received the specialty training needed to meet the complex challenges of any project, making them the most capable workforce in the region. From schools, highways, and pipeline projects to casinos and arenas, the operating engineers build any job, large or small. For over 100 years, Local 66 has provided superior service that our community can count on. They are your one-stop resource for qualified and productive operating engineers and heavy equipment mechanics. To learn more about the benefits of organized labor and more information about the International Union of Operating Engineers Local 66, go to www.iuoe66.org. That's www.iuoe66.org.
Imagine me, a dog, moving in with a human. I didn't know how it would work. Turns out, my human's pretty entertaining. For instance, every time I give my human his ball, he throws it as far as he can. And I'm like, dude, that's your ball. So I go get it. But he just throws it. Again. I gotta say, though, the more he does it, the funnier it is. I love my human.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and theshelterpetproject.org.
Welcome back to the Union Edge Labor's Talk Radio. I'm Brittany Sheets here with Angela Bachman.
Hello, Brittany.
And it's a happy Friday here in Pennsylvania. And on the line with us right now in Michigan, we have our good friend Buck Gino.
It's a pleasure to be with you, ladies, but actually I'm in Minneapolis, St. Paul today.
That's right. We're going to start calling you Waldo. Where in the world is Buck Gino?
Seriously.
You never know where he may show up. That's right. You know, there's an old saying that we have in the country, you know, a moving target's harder to draw a bead on.
That's true. That's very true. It's good.
Anyway, it's great to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you here.
Yeah. You know, we usually talk about what's going on in Michigan, so to start off with, you know, everybody's aware of the governor's power to appoint emergency managers over cities and schools and things that they consider not functional. Well, everybody knows they appointed an emergency manager to Detroit a while back. And what they did now is yesterday, they basically voted to approve a plan for removing the emergency manager.
Great. And who voted on this?
The city council.
Okay, great.
And so it was a unanimous vote. And then right away, you know, you got the Snyder standing up and saying, hey, you know, I'm all for this. Back to democracy. You know, of course, this is an election year. But the fine print on this thing is that they don't really get rid of the emergency manager. He's still there. He just has he's just going to stay out of the news so much. He still has the power to basically remove all the elected officials. Even approve or disapprove of, you know, what's going on in the bankruptcy thing. So it was really interesting to see this is strictly politically motivated so that Snyder can stand up and say, look what I did for Detroit, when in reality he didn't actually do anything.
Wait, so what did they actually vote on then?
To basically approve a plan for removing the emergency manager. So what it's a long-range plan, supposedly, for his departure.
But he's not really departing. He's still kind of there.
Not departing at all.
Okay,
well,
yeah.
Not kinda.
Yeah, if you could see the looks on our face right now, we're a little kind of just disgruntled, eyebrows kind of furled, like,
So this is one of those, like, maybe sometime within the next 20 years or something, we'll get rid of this guy.
Right. And okay. And in the meantime, if you don't do things we want you to do, elected officials,
goodbye.
Then we're going to kick you to the curb.
My thoughts on that is whenever you said how he's just going to be quote-unquote out of the news, I kind of like chuckled a little bit. I'm like, all right, he's going to be out of the news, but he can still take out all of the elected officials and push his agenda and do what he has to do. But, you know, he's already been in the news for doing things that people don't like that aren't very good and aren't good for Michigan. So who are you going to pinpoint that on if he's quote-unquote staying out of the news? Unless you stop him from doing these things, he is still responsible for his actions. So...
Right, right. And, you know, like I said...
Have they thought about this?
Well, I just was pointing it out because, you know, it's they put it on pretty much in all conservative areas. They put this on the front page and say, look at our guy, how wonderful he is. But they don't tell you about the 300 or 400 people that are still having their water shut off daily there.
Wow. I didn't know that was still going on.
Yeah. See, that's the you know what I mean? You got to get into... You know, the little things about really the way they are. And that's why, you know, it's so important for you ladies and Charles to do the work that you're doing is that, you know, it's just like you got to see how the people really feel.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to get that out to, you know, hopefully everybody's educated and registered to vote and make some changes. But, you know, Michigan especially, my heart's there, but, you know, you look at the way this political system is set up, and they only have one agenda, really,
mm-hmm.
and that is to take over complete power, taking away control of smaller governments, such as townships, cities, villages, combining them with either the counties or in some cases, maybe even the state, to basically, you know, have total control. And,
yeah.
You know, it's
I believe that, isn't that called dictatorship?
Sure it is. Yeah, but they're doing it at such a pace and making, you know, people, you know, I don't know.
It's going to take years to undo the damage that they're doing.
Oh, really? It does. And one of the things that we find is that when we go around and we elect our progressive friends, the ones that are supposed to help us, when they get into office, they say, oh, boy, can't we all just get along?
Mm-hmm. That's true. I mean, if you look at the current state of the government, we are in such a gridlock, we can't get anything passed because of the two sides just oppose each other so much that nobody will get along. Whether it's even, like, something that is just, honest to goodness, good for the people. And if they decide that, you know, I'm just going to get back at you for it in a very petty way... You know, things don't get through, things don't get passed, and, I mean, look at it. They're called the Do-Nothing Congress for a reason.
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about that at 2:30 when we talk about the fact of what politics are and how politics haven't changed.
Well, it looks like I just teed that up for you.
It hasn't changed for 100 years here. And like I said... You know, it's interesting for this state and some of the extreme right movement that was made. I mean, from Right to Work to, taking away the woman's right to have insurance that covers the health issues for her. I mean, this thing is, and, you know, you talk to the people here, I'll give you an example, in Minnesota, they're shocked.
Wow.
They're shocked that those kinds of things happen. Just like, I drove through Wisconsin. You know, I saw some walker signs, and I saw some, you know, and you stop and you see people, and it's the same thing. And ladies, what I see sometimes, even you can feel a tinge of it here in Minnesota, is when things are going well,
mm-hmm.
you're making a good living. Say, like back in the day when Bill Clinton was office, what happens is the people, us, the progressives, or us, or even union members, we say, hey, things are good. We're doing all right. We're making money. We're living right. God darn it. I'm going to start paying attention to the social issues.
Mm-hmm.
I'm already making the money. And that's what happens to us. That is what happens every time we elect a right-wing president. We get so complacent. If you look at history, check it. We do well. Look at, you know, most people will tell you that when Bill Clinton was the president, they never did so good, even the stock market.
Whoa,
what happens is we start, and when we got around to elected the election between Gore and Bush, even our members said, God darn it, they're going to take my guns. I got my money. We're always going to have a job.
I never thought about it in those terms, Buck. That really makes a lot of sense. It's so simple.
Believe me. Yeah. And that's what we got to guard against.
It's kind of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Whenever you like you meet one need, then like you have time to concentrate on other things.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
You know, and it's interesting, you know, and like I said, not to belabor that, we'll talk a little bit with a historian, perhaps 2:30, but it isn't, it's the same, it's the same. To give you a little thing, you know, I'll give you an example. The example is you hear all the Republicans and the extreme right are yakking at Obama, saying how unpatriotic he is because he saluted the veterans with a latte in his hand.
Oh, we talked about this earlier.
I know, but if you look back when Franklin Roosevelt was in office, they belabored his wife because she was driving around and using too much gas talking to people.
Right. Well, I actually just read an article about it saying that it was actually Ronald Reagan who started that saluting trend and that no one before him ever did that.
Yeah.
So you can't point to, like, historically, well, Abraham Lincoln would have done that. Like, no one did that before Reagan. And Reagan was questioned about it when he started, like, you know, is that really appropriate? But the answer was, well, you're the president. You can do whatever you want. So he did.
But the point is that the acknowledgement of the veteran, it's just like they're sitting there. One of these days, you ladies, you'll be sitting in there in your tables, and your husband will be standing next to you, and you'll be standing there and drinking wine and looking at all your friends or whatever, and you'll stand up and you'll say, you take a glass of champagne or Coke or whatever you drink, and you look up and you say to your husband, here's to you. It's the acknowledgement.
Mm-hmm.
It's not whether we have a latte in our hand or a bottle of champagne or we have nothing and we salute. It's the acknowledgement of our veterans. And that's the pettiness, what I'm getting back to, that the Republicans would complain about that.
That's true. Well, it looks like we're coming up to the end of things here. This has been very interesting. We've really spanned a lot of topics today.
Yeah, we have.
Yeah.
Well,
it was good having coffee with you.
Exactly. I was going to say, it's been great talking to you, and we will have you back on here later at 2:30 with our friend Michael Johnston. Got him back on the show.
Have a good one, lady.
All right, you too,
you
Buck.
Too.
That was Buck Gino of Work in Progress Radio. I'm Brittany Sheets here with Angela Bachman, and you've been listening to The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Hotel workers in Los Angeles won a major victory as the LA City Council voted this week to raise the minimum wage at large hotels to $15.37 an hour. That vote was 12-3. Already, some hotels are threatening to sue to block the wage hike. The council members who voted for the wage increase say it will lift thousands of working people out of poverty. Rachel Torres is an organizer with the Raise LA Coalition.
A lot of hotel owners already pay this wage and want to see uniformity in the market. But of course, there are those who want to, you know, stand on the wrong side of history and sort of believe that poverty is the way to go. The city also is going to be looking at a citywide proposal. So unlike years before, they had said, oh, why are you targeting one industry? Well, in fact, the city is going to be looking at all industries, and we believe that the hotel industry is the first industry that can afford it. It's seen record profits, but I believe that, you know, setting a strong precedent in a strong industry will help mobilize and help move forward the citywide proposal that the council and the mayor are really eager to push forward as well.
Torres says labor activists who made this happen in Los Angeles are hopeful that it can inspire similar actions across the country.
We're hopeful that if we can do this here, that we set a strong precedent, not just for our city, but for the county and for other cities across the country to do that.
The $15.37 an hour hotel minimum wage in Los Angeles is effective next July for hotels with at least 300 rooms. A year later, it will apply to hotels with at least 150 rooms. The United States is moving to enforce labor rights provisions in its trade agreement with Guatemala. Radio Labor's C. Marie Ainsborough reports.
Unions fighting to help workers in Guatemala have won a major victory. The United States government has announced that it will begin the formal process within a trade agreement to investigate labor rights abuses in Guatemala. This is the first time the United States has used the disputes mechanism in a trade agreement to investigate the enforcement of labor rights. The decision comes after a long campaign by the largest union federation in the United States, the AFL-CIO. 6 years ago, the Federation partnered with Guatemalan unions and filed a petition alleging widespread and serious labor rights violations. One of the charges against the Guatemalan government is that it has not investigated numerous murders of union leaders. The legal proceedings initiated under the provisions of the trade agreement with Guatemala initiates an arbitration process which could force the country to live up to its promises to respect labor rights.
Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.